Okay, the a couple of things that I'm assuming you're all keeping track of the emails that are flowing through. There is a experimental wiki that I set up. It works. The question is whether or not it will become useful depends on you. So there is basically what I will do is after every class I'll just make an entry like this, and then I will write down some names, some topics that I thought were discussed in the class that were not probably adequately represented in the slides themselves. Okay, so if they're in the slides, you probably don't need to necessarily rewrite it. So then I'll leave you to fill it. You know, if I have time, I'll fill it. Otherwise, people can fill it. And you can always add. You know, how many of you know, or how many of you don't know? Actually, how many of you know how to do editing in Wikipedia? Yeah, you should learn, because I mean, somebody is going to put a bio on you, and you need to keep changing it. Otherwise, you know. So it's extremely easy. This is, I think it's a, you know, a Drupal editor, I think. So, you know, if you want to edit this, you just go like that, and then, you know, that's how it looks. It's very simple. And then, you know, you can always learn by example. You can take mine and then, you know, copy over. So, for example, if you put like three equal signs on both sides, then it becomes a big heading. That's it. Okay, and then things like here, like you can add internal link, external link, and all fun stuff. And then, you know, if we wind up needing it, I don't know whether LaTeX is actually working right now, but you can add LaTeX mathematical formulas too. Okay, so I'll do that, and you know, this is Wiki, so if in fact people make mistakes, other people can just modify it. Okay, right now my assumption is that I was asking people to sign in. As far as I know, well, Dustin just signed in, I guess. There is Karthik and Michael23, and you know, some of you did not yet. I don't quite know why Nanan got in, but anyway. So I think this is also being used as my group wiki separately. But the class people, you know, if once you all sign in, my hope is that I can just remove the create login window. And then, you know, and then I can just make you into a group, and you will have basically the ability to edit the pages. Okay, right now anybody in the world can edit. Not that people are dying to edit belief search pages right now. I mean, it's not exactly Mark Sanford's page. So there is okay. I think we can live for about a week. But, you know, you can try and see how far it goes. I cannot promise to look at the errors in this stuff. It's Wikipedia, you know, and so it's just your collective wisdom or lack thereof. Okay. Okay. That's where that thing is. We can try that. And in fact, you know, this is another way of judging, I guess, participation, right? If people are busy keeping notes, then that would be one way of judging participation. Okay. So that's about the wiki thing. The other thing is, you know that next Monday is a holiday, right? It's a Labor Day weekend, so it's a holiday, so we won't have a class. So you have a lot of time on your hands, and you can start thinking about, you know, remember there were two parts that you're supposed to do. One is, you know, figure out a project for the entire semester. The other is to figure out which topic in the HKI proceedings are you going to pick and read papers and, you know, write sort of a survey and then present it. Okay. So my suggestion is, I don't know how many of you have actually bothered to look at the proceedings till now. Okay. More of you need to do it. And I want by next week, essentially, I want people to identify their top two topics. Okay. Into which, I mean, if you know which topic you want to read on, that's fine. And if you know which papers you want to read on, that's also fine. Okay. What I will do is, since we have a wiki, I'll make a wiki page, and then you enter saying my name, your name, and the topic that you are looking for are the specific papers that you're planning to read. Okay, and then that way at least you'll start making progress. And hopefully this will also get you start thinking about what project you want to do for the course. That's also related. Okay. That's one point. The other one is the possibility of Friday's makeup class. So next week we'll only have one class because, you know, there's Labor Day weekend. And it so happens that I will be out of town on 9:21 and 9:23. I won't be here at all. So I have two options. One is, let somebody come and do something. I prefer to do makeup classes myself if possible. So one idea is, since it's a small enough class, if pretty much all of you, especially all of you registered, are available, I'd like to have like one of the makeup classes on next Friday. So that would be just two classes for the week. And then I'll have to make up one more class, which we will do sometime later. Okay, so the question is, how many of you might be able to come on 9/11 Friday for a makeup class? I would basically, to make it simple, I'll just say the same time. Okay? So how many of you can, it's easier to do the other way around. How many of you cannot make it? One, and just one. Okay. So more likely than not, I'm going to have a Friday afternoon, I'm going to have, a class. Okay, I'll confirm it by next Wednesday, so you will know, 2 days in advance. Okay, so that's that. Are there any other questions related to this kind of stuff?
I have a question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Long term, yeah.
But a project?
Yeah. No, the project, you can do anything. You can pick any project. This one is only about, I don't know whether I have the slides here, but let me show you. So we talked about two things that we'll be using for evaluation in the class. Okay, so this was what I was talking about last time, right? So this is the participation. This is a semester-long project. This you can decide, but you need to talk to me. And then there'll be a time for a proposal where you tell me what you're planning to do, and then there'll be an end of the semester you need to actually deliver on what it is that you're going to deliver on. It depends on what kind of a project it is. I mean, in the sense that if it is proving a theorem, a write-up would be enough. If it is actually a software artifact, you should at least demonstrate it to me, right? It depends. So this is like, quite open-ended. I mean, you can decide what you want to do. And as I mentioned, it can be in groups of two, it can be just single person project, or it can also be in groups of two. Okay. And, only in exceptional circumstances will I consider three. I think it will be too many people and some people get to sleep. So then this is what I was talking about for the next week. So you kind of need to learn to read state-of-the-art papers, some of which you're anyway going to do here, but, Ichikai 2009 is as raw in the wild as it can get. It just came out, right? So you look at 2009 proceedings, so you'll pick some papers from the Ichikai 2009 as a starting point. And then, of course, you need to decide, you have to pick a topic. You have to, look at what is it that's interesting to you. So if natural language processing is interesting to you, you can pick a couple of papers on that. I'll try to help you as to how to, it's a hard thing to present those things because it's, they're going to be, depth first mostly. They're kind of deep and may not be connected as much to other things that have already been discussed. Okay, but I want to see if everybody is interested in, for example, planning, it's easy for me because I don't know exactly what they should read, I can help them. But, this is not a planning class necessarily, this is an AI class, and you can be interested in anything you want in each guy proceedings, and then you tell me first what topics you think you would be interested in. You only need one topic and maybe a couple of papers. Okay, that's basically what I'm talking about. Any other questions? Okay. Okay. So, today's agenda, of course, as I said in my mail as well as last class, is we'll complete the discussion on beyond classical search. And maybe towards the end of today, we will start talking about the other paper, the next one in line, which is Dan Blythe's paper on doing these things under propositional representation. How many of you have started looking at that paper? Okay, so you probably found some of the same terminology. You're talking about belief states. You're talking about observational actions. You're talking about A and, you know, and R search. So what exactly is the big difference? Representation. In fact, we'll talk a little about it today, but essentially, instead of talking about explicit state representation, you are using a propositional representation for the states. That makes something simpler, more compact. Okay? So that's basically, and then of course, that paper also talks a lot about what kind of heuristics you might need. But essentially, you can think of that paper as this is where, in terms of the layout of the topics that are coming up, so we are done on non-deterministic actions, partial observability, and we'll do partial observability today, and we'll also do online search today. Okay, and then all of these are being done under atomic representations because we're thinking of explicit states. Okay, I mean, all of this discussion is being done under atomic representation. And we also avoided talking about stochastic models. So basically, we are assuming non-deterministic means anything will happen, but we don't know what probabilities are there. Okay, so starting from here, I could go talk about generalization of the representation such that it becomes more compact, propositional representation. That's more or less what we will do in discussing, you know, Bryce's stuff, the conformant planning and conditional planning in Pond Planner. Okay, so essentially this is doing this and this except in the propositional representation, and it talks about what heuristics to use, how to, you know, actually, you know, control the search and so on. Okay, so you can think of this either as what is the state of the art in, you know, finding reasonable heuristics for non-deterministic actions and partial observability, and also within, you know, but not explicit state models, but with state variable models. Okay, and then we'll actually, more likely than not, after that I'll come back to this side again, where I will still be in the atomic representation, but I'll throw in probabilities. Okay, if I do that, then we get to talk about Markov decision processes. In fact, non-deterministic actions with probabilities and full observability will get you to what's called MDPs, or MDPs for short, but really the full technical term is fully observable Markov decision processes, FOMDPs. Okay, and then the other one is if you have non-deterministic as well as partial observability and probabilities. So that means you know the transition probabilities for the actions. And then you will have FOMDPs, which is still at the atomic level. It's still the whole representation at the atomic level. But you're talking about what's the solution concept? Okay, a solution concept for A-star search was a sequence of actions. A solution concept for non-deterministic, you know, worlds is a tree, right? And similarly, a solution concept for MDPs really can be thought of as a tree or a policy. They're basically, you know, connected. Essentially, you need to know what to do in each state. And then, in particular, because we have probabilities, we'll see that in the case of MDPs, we can talk about not just a strong plan, which is always succeeds. You can talk about two different plans, one which succeeds 90% of the time and one which succeeds, you know, 40% of the time. And you can distinguish between them, because you have, you know, a normative measure for doing that. And so, in fact, the nice thing about looking at MDPs, and I know some of you in 471 already done it, but we'll look at it again once more with a different paper this time, is that they actually allow you to formally specify what should be the optimal solution. What is an optimal policy? In fact, there was a question last class, and we talked about how do we talk about optimal conditional plans. But if you throw in probabilistic transitions, and you can also throw in fact, one other thing that you will wind up doing is you will allow rewards to be collected at any state, not just in the final state. If you do that, then it winds up being a more general atomic model which sort of subsumes everything here. Actually, MDPs subsume everything but partial observability. And PalmDPs subsume everything, period. Okay? And then once we learn how to do that in the stochastic atomic level, we can then start talking about how to do them more efficiently in the propositional level. That's the general idea. So this is the layout, you know, as to where we are going to go for the next approximately a month or so. Yes, sir.
You're talking about the conciseness of propositional descriptions of the domain.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the most? Is there a more concise method than propositional descriptions, or do you think
you can have first order representation? So in fact, I think you know you missed again. There was a class when we were talking about levels of representation: atomic, propositional, relational, and first order, and you can go higher too.
Yeah.
Okay, the more concise the representation, of course. In fact, interestingly enough, this is a interesting point. Right, it turns out that complexity increases. Complexity class increases if you look at concise description. How many of you understand this? Why does that make sense? Somebody who only understands it partially should answer it. No, not just that. So think about the following thing, okay? So classical planning, which is basically the propositional version of the classical search, it turns out that its complexity is P space complete. So that's considered to be higher than NP complete. Okay, MDPs, fully observable MDPs, finding the optimal policy for fully observable MDPs is only polynomial. And you should be worried, right? Because MDPs are more general than classical planning. And how can it be that this is polynomial, whereas this is higher complexity? The special case cannot be more complex than the general case. And why is it? Because complexity is always in terms of the input size. Complexity is always in terms of the input size. In fact, those of you who have taken complexity courses realize that unary representation, you don't even talk about it. You assume, you know, logarithmic representation, at least. Okay, and so in particular, what happens here is this is polynomial in the number of states, which makes sense for MDPs because MDPs assume explicit states normally. Okay, classical planning thinks in terms of number of state variables. If you have n state variables, then there are really 2 power n states. And this is polynomial in 2 power n. So if you think of input as the number of state variables, then it is actually it's exponential.
You're saying they're equivalent?
Yeah, basically. So when I say polynomial for MDPs, you know, you talk about complexity of a problem class based on the default input representation that problem class gets. And normally, you know, MDPs, if you don't say anything else, you assume their input is in terms of the number of states. So that's the input size. For classical planning, normally you assume that it's not the number of states, it's the number of state variables, which is logarithmic in the number of states. Okay, so the point for your answer, the answer for your thing is that as we go into more and more concise descriptions, paradoxically, we will be realizing that our problem becomes more complex, but it's actually computational complexity-wise, it's higher complexity. Okay, but in terms of actual practical performance, these are equivalent essentially because here the input is in terms of number of states, this is in terms of number of state variables, and most of the time, the propositional methods for solving MDPs, for example, wind up being faster than the state-oriented methods, and the expectation is that the first order methods for solving them would be faster than the propositional methods. That's the expectation. The problem, of course, is we have to come up with those methods. They are much fewer and far between right now. You know, we know approximately how to do propositional methods for most of these things. First order methods, we know for some of them and not all. Okay? So that's the reality. So the expectation is that if you can represent the problem concisely, then there are two advantages. One is, of course, it's easier to write, and the other is search actually can be faster. But then you need to manage these higher order representations. Okay? Other questions? Yes?
Are you talking about when you have proposition approach, is that a search instead of using directly the dynamic programming in MDP?
Yeah, I know. So basically, if you do deterministic MDPs, classical planning can be done as deterministic MDPs.
Yeah.
But it's not particularly efficient. And they will have both the same exact complexity. But it's not any more efficient. In fact, MDP version turns out to be not as efficient because oftentimes, you know, it's much better to come up, you know, for the case of deterministic problems, really you don't need a full policy. And you can be much more directed rather than compute the full optimal policy. Again, this answer may or may not make sense to those people. I mean, those of you who have already thought about MDPs from 471, it'll make sense. Otherwise, we'll come back to it. Yes?
The only reason MDPs aren't as fast as, say, propositional methods are that you use, for example, heuristics
mm-hmm.
to speed things up in propositional methods. And you don't really have something like that in MDPs, like over the state space.
It's not just that. So I've decided that originally I was going to read, I was going to just use MDPs chapter for MDPs. But I've decided we'll use the Boutillier's paper, the 95-page paper. It's, you know, nicer and, you know, more warmer to hold. And then he spends a lot of time talking about, you know, this exact issue. For example, one of the things that, you know, what you have, you don't realize the advantages of it. You know, if you're used to propositional methods, you don't quite realize, you know, how many of those would be missing if you are stuck with state-oriented methods. For in particular, those of you who already know regression-based planning, right? It's not at all obvious how to do regression-based planning in explicit states. Because in essence, what regression-based planning says is, if I have some sort of a logical formula talking about the initial state, and I have another logical formula talking about the goal state, then I basically regress these goals over the actions to get regress goal states until the goal state I have is entailed by the initial state.
Sure.
Right? This is very easy to do in the propositional level. But think of doing this in actual graph corresponding to state. You know, there is a state graph with connections, right? And doing regression essentially means you are starting at multiple points on this graph and are making backward sweeps at the same time. Because a goal in, you know, planning can correspond to multiple possible states. Because you normally don't say everything that must be true in your state, you only talk about the few things that you care about. So there are, you know, a goal formula might be, you know, might be consistent with many explicit states here. And when you do regression, in essence, you are trying to find a graph search with multiple sources in the backward direction. That you can do easily here, which is actually an advantage. And you take it for granted because you have it. Okay?
You can still do it there. I mean, just give it to the vector processor and...
What you would eventually do is you will reinvent propositional representations. That's what you'll do.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, so that's basically, you know, keep this in mind. I might improve this picture, but it sort of gives you what we are trying to do. So today we'll do these two, and then next we'll get to this, and then after that we'll get to these. And then when we are done here, we can again come here to, you know, planning-based methods, propositional representations for MDPs. And you are welcome to pick first-order, you know, methods for planning, first-order methods for MDPs as a topic that you would read about. There are papers in Ichikai, for example, on those. I won't discuss them in the class, you know. Okay, so we did this, we're going to do this. We sort of started talking about partial observability last time, and if you have full unobservability, then essentially we need to talk about how to project. So you start talking about the belief states, which are actual subset of states in the world, and then if you know the action transition function, then you can apply those an action to every state in this subset, compute the new state that will come, and then union them. That will be the new belief state. Okay, one slight headache, of course, is what if the action that you are doing is not defined for one of the 20 states in the belief state? It's just not defined. So if it's not defined, theoretically, if you chose, when you said undefined, that means you are essentially saying if you try to do this action in this world, the world ends. That's what you're saying representationally. Okay, instead, you could actually, so if you do that, then of course, if you really believe that, if you said that when an action is not applicable in a state, if you try to push it by doing it, then, essentially the world ends. Okay, in which case, you should be sure that, you want to make sure that the only states you consider are the ones in which, so basically you can say that an action is applicable in a belief state only if it is applicable in every one of the states. Okay, and what he was talking about here is if you are at a belief state and you are trying to do a progression search, you need to decide which actions can be considered in the progression. Okay, and what if you actually have the possibility that actions can be inapplicable in certain states, then you will only consider the intersection of all the actions that are applicable in all the states. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, if you have S1 and S2 as the belief state, and in the normal case, in S1 you can do A1, A2, A5, and in S2 you can do A2, A3, right? That basically means A2 is not defined, A2 is defined in S1 and S2, but A1 is not defined in S1, A3 is not defined in okay? So now, if the only actions I can consider projecting from here are in the intersection of these two lists, because those are the only ones that will be applicable in all the actions. It's a very simple point. Okay? Another idea is, of course, to say every action is applicable in every state. Every action is applicable in every state, but you decide that you say that it won't change the state if it's not applicable. So the way you define inapplicability is every action can be done in every state, the world won't change if this action is not applicable. It'll just remain in the old state. And if you do it that way, then it becomes much simpler. Then you essentially just take the union of all these action sets, and all of them can be done. Okay, so that's the point that they were making, and in fact, there is something to be said for thinking of actions as always being executable in terms of modeling, but in terms of search, all you are interested in is the complexity of search, I would argue that it's better to have actions that are inapplicable in some states. Why? Basically, if I take intersection, the branching factor reduces. Union branching factor increases. Okay? So I can artificially, if I have a world where most actions are not applicable in most states, then most things can be done. But I'm only a search guy. I get paid for saying very quickly, yes, it can be done, no, it can't be done. And so I'll get to tell you every time you came with a goal saying, oh, it can't be done. Because it won't be done. Most of the time, some action would not be applicable in one of the states. Every action is inapplicable in one of the states, and so the intersection winds up becoming empty. Okay? But from the modeling perspective, it's better to think of actions as being executable all over. And this is something that will come up when you're thinking of the Bryce paper. He talks essentially both about executability conditions for an action and causation conditions, which actually are written as conditional effects, which says if this is true before the action, this will be true after the action. And to make actions always executable, you just make the executability conditions empty and only have conditional effects. Okay. The other thing, of course, is once you do that, you can talk about the transition model, which is essentially you union if you can do action A1, let's say in this particular case, action A2 is being done here. So you consider doing A2 on S1. Let's say it will give me S1 dash, S1 double dash. I also do it on S2. I'll get S2 dash. I just union them. That's maybe my new belief state. That's it. Okay. So basically, I don't need a new transition model. I can construct the new transition model based on the classical transition model, which tells me what an action does on a single state. Okay. The other thing is that, and then I also said that you can stop as soon as the current belief state. So basically, you have a goal belief state. Okay, G1, G2, etc., G3, and I have some current belief state. I'm going in the progression direction. If every state here is in this, then you can stop. If not, you can't. That was a point that I made last time too, that because even if in fact most of the states in the belief states are in the goal state, but one isn't, you can't be sure that you can stop, right? So it's sort of weirdly like, in my mind, it's sort of weirdly like in A star search, you can't stop as soon as the goal state comes onto the queue. You have to wait until the goal state comes to the front of the queue. In that case, you do it because you want to make sure that optimality is ensured. Okay. But in this case, you do it to make sure that the soundness is ensured. Because if you don't do this, it's not even sound. Because you can say, I'm done, I've reached the goal, but you won't have reached the goal. Yes?
So in a sense, it's also kind of like a planning graph idea where you do the level expansion.
Mm-hmm.
This is for the heuristic. Here is actual planning. But then in the planning graph for the heuristic, you can know that if a certain thing hasn't been seen until then it's not possible. If a certain proposition isn't true at a given level, at level L, then there's no way of achieving it because you're relaxing something in the planning graph.
Mm-hmm.
And here it's the same idea that if there's no goal state at all, right? So it's kind of the opposite. It's not telling you anything about the goal being there, but it's telling you something about the goal not being there.
So if the current belief state doesn't contain any states in the goal state, then it won't be goal.
Yeah,
but it's also not a goal even otherwise.
Right, it's not as useful.
The other interesting thing that you could think about is what actually happens when you apply actions to belief states. If you think about the cardinality of the belief state as the number of states in it, okay, what actually is happening to these belief states when you apply actions? Are they always becoming larger? Are they always becoming smaller? Are they always remaining the same? It depends, obviously. So, for example, what happens? First of all, can you guys see that this is a general case of classical planning? If you're doing classical planning, this will still work. In classical planning, the initial belief state is a singleton because you know the initial state completely. And when you apply actions to a singleton belief state, is the belief state size supposed to increase or reduce or remain the same? It can actually do either. Except if you're doing deterministic actions, then from one state you can go only to one state. So in classical planning, because you have deterministic actions, so let me see, this is the slide to keep in mind. So in classical planning, when you have a complete initial state, that means belief state cardinality is one. And you have deterministic actions, that means when they're applied, they'll give you one state back. You apply it to one state, they'll give you one more state back. So it's always one size belief state. So you can either think of them as belief states or normal states. No difference. Okay. But in fact, if you actually did non-deterministic actions here, then the belief state size can increase. It can also reduce. Okay. So for example, here if you have incomplete initial state and deterministic action. So this is complete initial state and deterministic action. That's classical planning. If I have incomplete initial state and deterministic action, you start with a belief state of size 1. I'm sorry, size greater than 1 because it's incomplete initial state. And you're applying deterministic action. That means the belief state size cannot increase. It can reduce, but it cannot increase. Okay, the size of the belief state can actually be thought of as a positional uncertainty. The bigger it is, the little you know about where you are in the world. Okay, so for example, I have an N state in my world. What's the worst possible scenario I could have in terms of I don't know where the heck I am? I have a belief state, N states, not N variables. So, no, N states. So, it's just a belief state is of size N. That means I have no clue where I am. I could be in any one of these places. And as the belief state size reduces, that means the uncertainty is reducing. So one interesting thing to keep in mind in doing search in the space of belief states is there are really two issues you are interested in. Again, much of this discussion is also relevant in when you are reading the paper, Dan Bryce's paper, because it's all being discussed again in the context of planning propositional representations there. So if I have a belief state here, S1, etc. up to Sn, right? I could talk about how far these are to the goal state, goal belief state. And we talked about that last time. I could also talk about how big this thing is. The higher the cardinality, the more uncertain I am as to where I am. Okay, so think about, those of you who haven't already heard of this analogy, think about what you actually do if you wake up in an unfamiliar room and there's no lights and you need to go to a bathroom. Basically, you are somewhere in the room. You have no actual clue. Of course, you can try to put on the light, but assume that you can't put on the light. Basically, when you woke up, you have no clue exactly where. If you haven't remembered exactly where this bed is in the room, you don't know exactly where the position of the, your position is with respect to the bathroom door's position. So what do most people do? What? Feel around until, what do? You basically keep walking until you hit the wall. When you hit the wall, you reduce uncertainty. And then you start making progress. Okay? So in fact, when you do belief space search, there are two things that you are interested in making progress on. One is reduce the uncertainty, another is reduce the distance to the goal. Both are important, not just one of them. Because if you said all you need is to reduce the uncertainty, bomb the heck out of the place, then I'll know for sure that, I'm basically dead. So completely reduce the uncertainty. But then I'm now infinitely far away from the goal. At the same time, if you only think about reducing the distance to the goal, you could also have this cardinality problem. Okay, so we are discussing this cardinality issue because it actually makes sense. The amount of uncertainty in the state does affect how easy it is for you to go from there to the goal state. Yes?
In all these cases, do we assume that the belief state is always correct? Like that at least one of the states in the belief state will...
Yes, that's what we'll assume. So if you're not sure, then make your belief state bigger. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So if I tell you, I think you are in either room 1 or room 2, and you don't want to believe me, then just say, I must be in any one of the rooms in this entire building. Okay, so you can always increase the uncertainty of the initial state, then it would be fully observable. Okay, one of the interesting points that they make in the textbook is, once you search in the space of belief state, it's fully observable in the space of belief state. It's not observable in the space of normal state because you don't know where you are, but you can make it observable in the space of belief state. You can always just increase the uncertainty. Okay, that's a subtle point, but it's worth making. Okay, so in the case of incomplete initial state and deterministic actions, you start with a cardinality greater than 1, and the size of belief state during the search is never greater than the original size. It can reduce or remain the same, but it will never be greater. To increase the size of the belief state, you need a non-deterministic action. You need an action which takes one state and gives two states out. Okay. Now notice that in doing this, I'm assuming that I cannot have an action which takes one state and gives zero states out. Right? That's one way of reducing things. Because if an action takes one state and gives zero states out, that means it's inapplicable in that state. And that semantically, that means things are undefined now. So we'll always assume that an action, when it's applicable in a state, will at least give one state back, which could be the same state it started from, if you want to play it that way. Yes?
Is it possible that for some of the member states in the belief state, we don't have any idea of how far is it from the goal state?
That depends on your model. In fact, that actually is an interesting discussion that we'll get to, hopefully, at the online search. Here I'm assuming that I know the complete model of the world in the following sense. I know what happens if I do an action in a state. It's just that I didn't know which state I am in.
So, but it is possible that you have no idea how...
If you don't have... No. Again, I'll wait until the online search comes. Normally, if you have a full model, you have the ability to compute that distance. You may be lazy and didn't want to compute it. And if you really don't have a model, then yes, you won't have any idea. Yes? No, this one I started with complete initial state,
right.
Non-deterministic actions.
Right.
This, by the way, corresponds to the first part of the Beyond Classical Search that we discussed, where if you have complete initial state and full observability,
right.
And you have all you have is non-deterministic states, then essentially what you are doing is non-deterministic actions can, sorry, complete initial state. So non-deterministic actions, you're starting... Since you have complete initial state, you're starting with a belief state of size 1. But and since you're doing non-deterministic actions, before you actually look into the world, you know that it can be more than one state that you are in. So I'm about to toss the coin. I'm currently in a state where I haven't yet tossed the coin. Now, if I do the toss action, I could be in one of two states. Toss with heads up, toss with tails up. That's why the belief state size increased. No, but that's BI is initial, but I'm talking about all the belief states that you will see during the search. During the search, they can increase, they can also reduce. Everybody can reduce. So in fact, across the board, belief state size can reduce. Right? Because you can always do, you know, the reason why you can reduce the belief state size is because you can bomb the world. And you can bomb the world and take it back to, you know, like Big Bang era. And then you know that there's only one state left, right? And so you can always reduce the belief state size. It's just the problem is whether you'll get to the goal from there. Yes?
How effective would an algorithm be that first reduces, the very actually possible to reduce the belief state to 1 and then proceed those things?
That's a very good question, and if you read the next paper, it actually talks about some of those exact kinds of issues. So in fact, in that paper, you know, Dan talks about what's called cardinality heuristic. What he means by cardinality heuristic is a planner which tries to prefer states whose size is smaller, cardinality is smaller. And that was one of the first ideas that was tried before his work. And he compares that to his work which tries to do both at the same time and says it's better. So as you can expect, you know, sometimes it's better, but it's really the ones which take into account both the distance to the goal and the uncertainty tend to do better. No, I did not say you must choose one with the smallest number of belief states. Because if, as I said, bombing action is always possible, right? So assume that for every domain in the world, I allow you a bombing action, which will get you back to, you know, essentially the beginning of the time, okay? Now, that state basically is too far away from the goal state you want to get to. So it's true that we try to reduce the uncertainty to make progress to goal easier. But it's not a categorical statement. You need to kind of trade that off with also how the distance to goal changes. Yes?
So I have another comment. Actually, sometimes it's also possible that you have either a sensing action or you have an action that will reduce the cardinality. For example, you might have a paint action, right? And you paint the chair there. But
but your goal might be to have sell the red chair, but then painting some other chair red, right,
mm-hmm.
will not necessarily give you that reward.
That's basically,
so
no.
Reducing the cardinality will not necessarily get you to your goal, is what I'm saying. I'm saying it's not the...
It depends on how your goal is defined.
Yeah.
It turns out that it depends on, in fact, that question that you're asking about is, should you sense or not sense?
Right, right.
And that basically kind of goes back to the broad spectrum antibiotic, and we'll talk about more of it in a minute if I get out of the slide. Okay, so that's the, and then finally, if you have incomplete initial state on non-deterministic actions, you start with a belief state of size greater than 1, and it can both increase and reduce. It changes non-monotonically based on the actions you're doing. So this is not a huge thing, but if you understand this, you understood what's in this slide. I mean, you can just go through this slide without really realizing how the belief state sizes, you know, change. And some of you who already understood, sorry for wasting your time. But the others, you know, you may not have looked at that. Okay. Now, the paper actually, the book actually talks about what is hard about belief state search, one of which we already talked about, which is how to define heuristics, and we will talk, look at that in the paper next time. But the other interesting question he talks about is how do you, the problem is the size of the belief state itself. In, you know, in many worlds, the belief state size can be really, really large. Okay, and just taking them along for the ride becomes a problem, is the point they're making. Okay, now how do you handle that? It turns out that basically that's what your propositional representations, let me see if I can get there. The propositional representations are one way of dealing with that. Okay. So the point is, and again, this is something that will become more clear when you're reading Dan's paper, but if, in fact, if you don't know at all, so if you have, so first understand that if you have states represented in terms of state variables, then really, and if these variables are Boolean variables, then really you can think of each state as a conjunctive Boolean formula, which mentions each one of the state variables. So there's a literal corresponding to each state variable. If it's positive, that means it's supposed to be true. If it is negative, it means it's supposed to be false. Okay? So states, complete states are really, if you have a domain with just four variables, P, Q, R, and S, then a state is nothing but a conjunctive formula on P, Q, R, S. All of them must be taking part in it. Okay? Which is exactly why there are supposed to be how many states? 2^4. 16 states. So there are 16 complete formulas. But is that the only propositional formulas you can write on four propositions? Of course not. Okay? What you could do is, for example, belief states really are sets of states. That's what we said. Suppose I want a belief state which is this state as well as this state. Then I take this logical formula, R it with this logical formula. When I do that, R and not R go away, then basically what I have is P and Q and S. So in this particular case, belief state is smaller. I mean, the representation for the belief state is smaller than the representation for the individual states. This is not surprising. In fact, if you know nothing, in the sense if you think you could be in any one of these 16 states, what would be the logical formula to represent that? If you are in any one of the 15 states, then what would be the logical formula that represents that belief state? Because that would be the largest belief state you have to represent in the explicit model, right? What would it be on the other side? It'll be just true. Every state, yes, I'm in that. Okay? So, in a very interesting way, you know, the size of the formula is not directly proportional to the size of the cardinality. In fact, formula sizes can increase quite badly, but they don't have a direct connection to the belief state size. And so if you're searching in the space of in the propositional representations, what matters to you is the formula size, not the number of states. So that's one good reason to look into the propositional representations. So in fact, one of the things we can wind up thinking about is really a belief state in a propositional representation is a propositional formula. That's it. Now, propositional formulas can have canonical representations. One canonical representation for propositional formula is CNF, conjunctive normal form. Another is DNF, disjunctive normal form. A third one, which you never heard of, but you know, has any of you heard of binary decision diagrams? Binary decision diagrams, you know, so here are the examples. So consider the formula like this. P implies Q and P implies S. This, by the way, is my belief state. Okay? Because in fact, belief states can be crazy formulas like that. So for example, suppose in the bomb in the toilet problem, I want to say that the bomb is either in package 1 or in package 2, but not both. I have to write an XOR, logically. Writing an XOR in logic would involve writing two formulas, right? Because XOR is not one of the, you know, normal connectives. Okay, so here I'm saying if P is true, then Q must be true, and if P is true, S must be true. That's the only thing I know about the world I live in. Do you understand what I'm saying? I have no clue what R is. I have no clue what P is, what Q is, what S is, but if P is true, Q and S must be true. That's all the states that are consistent with my beliefs. And I can write that as a little formula. Okay? This formula can be written in CNF form, in DNF form. CNF is a conjunction of clauses where each clause is a disjunction of literals. And a DNF is the opposite. It's a disjunction of clauses where each clause is a conjunction of literals. Okay? And then, so, don't yet look at this. So, suppose I'm trying to do progression in this space. Progression in the space. What representation looks sort of more natural for progression? What representation looks more natural for the progression?
DNF.
What?
Yeah.
CNF or DNF? Only one of them. So, yeah. CNF. You say CNF. You say?
I
you say CNF too?
I would say DNF is probably easier. DNF
okay.
To work with. Yeah.
DNF. Basically, look at what a complete state looks like. This is how a complete state looks like. A complete state is a conjunction of literals. All literals. Okay, the thing that looks like a complete state, or at least a piece of the complete state, is DNF. It turns out that actually DNF representation is more natural for progression. You can do anything with anything, but DNF representations are more natural for progression. Again, this is a point Dan makes in his paper. Okay, and similarly, it turns out that CNF is a more natural representation for regression, because goals normally give you flexibility. Saying either do this or this or this. Okay? Now, so those are two representations. A third representation for logical formulas is, it's a canonical representation, it turns out, is, in fact, it's a more interesting canonical representation than these two, is BDDs, binary decision diagrams, are in particular what's called ordered binary decision diagrams. Okay? Have any of you heard about this? Yeah, binary decision diagrams. Yeah. Binary decision diagrams. Have any of you heard? How many of you are computer engineering majors at some point of time? And you should have heard about this. Because the entire verification community runs on binary decision diagrams. Okay? Because think of what, in fact, it's a kind of a weird connection. Think of what a verification person is trying to do. They're given an arbitrary circuit, which has an arbitrary transition function. You know, these are some R's, these are some ands, and if I know what comes in the R, then I know what comes out of it. Okay? I can basically have to say, to verify things won't end, I have to say for any possible input vector, no fault occurs on the output side. That's what a verification is about. If for a single one, you can verify. You can just run it through the circuit and say, yeah, there's no fault. Okay? You can do 8 of them and say, yeah, it looks like there's no fault. But really what you have to consider is all possible input vectors, which is a very hard thing to do, which is why, you know, at the Pentium time, I don't know how many of you are old enough, but only 5 years back, 6 years back, Intel came up with this Pentium chip, which had a flaw. It turns out that for certain floating point arithmetic, it will give wrong answers. Because they couldn't, you know, they assumed that they verified everything, but they didn't verify that part, and that, you know, fault didn't get detected. Now, it turns out that verification is taking a belief state, which is a set of possible initial states, and it's trying to prove that they will satisfy liveness properties, they will satisfy safety properties. So verification is very well connected to what we are trying to do here, planning and, you know, finding a solution. And so what those guys did, you know, in that community, the model verification community, they came up with this, you know, BDD representation. And the reason you need this representation is one of the interesting things you want to do is checking if you have reached a state previously, right? In the normal state search, you would like to be able to do that. Now, if you're trying to do it in the belief state search, how do you do that? You have to say whether, you know, I have a CNF or a DNF representation, and I have another CNF or DNF representation, I want to say whether they're equivalent. What's the cost of finding equivalence of logical formulas? Pretty darn bad. It's again NP-hard. You cannot find equivalence of logical formulas, you know, in any efficient way. General logical formula. So what you wind up doing is that it turns, because the same formula can be written into multiple different CNF and DNF forms. And so the interesting thing then is that BDDs have this property that you essentially pay it forward, you pay it up front when you're constructing the BDD, such that equivalent formulas would have the exact same tree structure. In fact, it's sort of a directed graph structure. So checking whether two formulas are equal becomes a O1 operation. That's why BDDs are very interesting. Okay, so in Dan's paper, for example, he'll talk about, oh, we basically use BDD representations for belief states. Okay, and it's because it has that advantage, and there are, of course, software packages which can manipulate BDDs. Okay, we'll talk a little about that. I might give you some reading on that, but again, it's like, there's a whole entire literature on how to, you know, manipulate binary relation diagrams. So the connection to our class is they provide a compact and canonical and unique representation for any logical formula. Once you decide on the order of the variables, then there is only one BDD that corresponds to any logical formula. It's a very useful thing. Okay. And so, in fact, when you have BDDs, people try doing all sorts of interesting things. For example, they will take the belief state, write it as a BDD. They will consider doing all actions at the same time on this BDD. So if I do this action, I'll get a formula. If I do this action, I'll get a separate formula. If I do this action, I'll get a separate formula. Really, what I have is this formula or this or this or this. That's a big formula itself. Write a BDD for that. That's what BDD search looks like. And it can be quite efficient in certain cases because you don't even have to decide which direction to go to some extent. You can do all actions at the same time. Of course, it will catch up with you at some point of time. You know, for smaller problems, you can do many actions at the same time, all actions at the same time. So breadth-first search in BDD is beautiful, right? Because it's just one state, you know, all actions, one state, all actions, one state. Each state is represented now as a BDD. Yes?
There's probably a problem with computer engineering. Actually, you can't do all actions at the time because everything is synchronized. Synchronous circuits
have to test. So some actions. No, don't ask me questions on computer engineering. I'm only making the connection.
How do you actually, what are the kind of engineering issues when you actually design binding sort of?
No, you're talking about verification, or you're talking about the solution techniques in confirm and planning?
Yeah, solution techniques, more not about computer.
That, read the paper, and we'll talk about it more next class. Okay? Okay, so that's regarding that one point. That's that point. Factoring to the rescue. So the way you handle the size of the belief state size is to represent as them as formulas and then manipulate the formulas. But it's not so much that formulas are any easy to manipulate. So you need to have canonical forms for the formulas, and you need to talk about manipulating them. Yes, sir.
So if you're going to be doing a BBB search and you're doing the OR thing for every possible answer, doesn't that just eventually tell you whether or not you reach the goal state?
But there are, of course, yeah, that's, yeah, so that, the nice thing, of course, is it's not unioning them. So it tells you not only reachability, but there are ways of getting the solution out of it. I did not explain to you the whole thing.
Okay.
But, you know, all I'm saying is you should be able to see the feasibility, because if I have 10 formulas, the disjunction of those 10 formulas is a formula too. Okay. And your point is very well taken. In fact, reachability is easy this way to check, but you know, getting the actual solution out is interesting, and there are some tricks that they use. Okay, so the next thing I want to do, and I'm going really slow, is observations. Okay, till now we didn't open our eyes. So we just had a belief state, we kept doing actions which just changed state to another state. Okay, first of all, what's the big difference between observations and actions? Observations are also actions, sort of. So what is the big difference between normal actions that you have seen till now, which are sort of causative actions, okay, and a pure observation action, which we know don't exist according to Heisenberg, but you know, to the extent we believe that pure observation is possible, what's the, yes?
Observations don't change your environment.
Observation is supposed to change only your head, except Heisenberg, you know, we'll ignore him for now.
No, but actions have a cost, like knowing what type of bacteria you have.
No, as I said, in fact, in fact, there's even other interesting things, actually. The pure observation, the model that you read in the textbook, essentially says, when you are in a state, it just automatically emits an observation, and you just automatically can detect it. That's the pure observation model. It's bogus, right? In fact, one of the things I'll point out is that not every state actually emits an observation that you can observe. Because observations are a complex property of the state and your sensor. Right now, some of you might be sleeping, some of you might be doing iPhone chats. Right now, you might be thinking, I'm able to do it under the table, so it can't be observed. So there is a part that you are able to make sure that it cannot be observed. And I'm also not looking at you, so I can avoid observing it. Right? So, or maybe my eyesight is bad, I can only look around this area, and if you are checking iPhone there, I can't see. So in fact, whether or not something is observable depends on both the agent and the environment. It's a complex property of both. But the simplest case is that a state just emits an observation and every agent can just catch it. That is what we'll understand today. And then anything else is more interesting, you know, generalization. Okay, so the idea, the model they used is states give out percepts that can be observed by actions and observations. And so if you do that, then what's the advantage of observation? If you have a belief state, S1, S2, S3, let's say, okay, and if it turns out that S1 always gives observation O1 and O2, S2 only gives observation O2, and S3 gives observation O2 and O3. It just affords that, possibly, right? Now, if I'm in this belief, so in fact, you know, I'm in this belief state, so I think I could be in any one of these states, and I actually observe in the world. And first of all, observations are only possible during the execution, not when you're thinking. I can't think as to whether or not, you know, a road is closed or not. I have to go there and see it.
You can plan to observe.
First, I mean, again, we're talking about pure observations, where the states just automatically give you the observation. Okay, so I'm in this state, and I just say, hey, what observations am I getting? And suppose I say, well, I'm getting observation O2. That turns out to be a pretty sad observation, right? It's a useless observation, because all states give that observation. So because you got O2, now you know, yeah, so I am still in S1, S2, S3. So if you got only this observation, Okay. So in fact, if on the other hand, so if you just got O2, that means you really could be in all three states. If on the other hand, I got O1, I know for sure that I must only be in S1 because neither of the other states could have given this. This actually goes back into your question. The reason I'm able to do this reasoning is I know for sure that this is the extent of my uncertainty, no more. So I'm certainly sure that I'm in S1 or S2 or S3, no other state. And now you're telling me that, you know, and I know this model. And you're telling me I get observation O1, I realize that I'm getting observation O1, that means really my state is S1. In this case, it actually became much smaller. Right? So actually if I made this more interesting and I said O2 and O1, then it will be two states. So in general, what an observation does is it reduces your belief space, state size. So you know more about where you actually are. Right? Okay? Now, the interesting question is, that's what happens in the search, in the execution. What does it do in the search? At the time of search, you have to consider the possibility that you could get any subset of these observations when you actually open your eyes. And so you have to consider what would be the belief state if that would be the observation you find. So during search, so during execution, observation reduces the belief state size or leaves it alone. Okay? During search, it partitions the belief state such that the union of all belief states is the original belief state. You understand what I'm saying? So in a way, actually, observing introduces a sort of an AND branch in the belief state space. It's almost, observing is like doing a non-deterministic action in the normal state. Remember? So if I am in the state S1 and I do a toss action, I can get S1 heads, S1 tails. Those are two different states. I don't know which one. At the execution, I'll know which one because I'll get the observation. Okay, now I came to the belief state. Now if I have a belief state B1 and I consider doing, you know, observation action, I consider all the possible observations I can get, O1, O2, or O3, let's say, then essentially if I get O1, this would be my belief state. If I get O2, this will be my belief state. If I get O3, this will be my belief state. If I union this, I'll get B1 back. So this is a partition of these belief states. And since at the goal state, during the thinking time, I don't know which state actually I will be in, it will become an AND branch. And I need to go from each of these to goal state. So it's AND OR search. You understand what I'm saying? Except it's an AND OR search in the space of belief states, whereas fully observable non-deterministic actions were AND OR search in the space of singleton states. Yes?
If we have two states and each state has the same set of observations, can we consider both as the same state?
No. Not at all. No. So it depends on, so the question of course is, when can I say that two states are equivalent? Only if states actually emit their state identifiers as the observation. Right? So think about the following thing. Let's say all I can see is the color of one shirt. And I see you have sort of greenish shirt, he has sort of greenish shirt. That's the only thing I can see. Am I sure you're both the same? From color of the shirt, yes. But there's a huge number of other observations I'm not getting. The reason, this is the part which makes this partially observable. A state, if it gives enough information to completely reconstruct it back, then it's fully observable. In our model, a state is fully observable if it gives essentially like S1 back. So a state S1 gives S1 as the observation, in essence. Then you know that it's fully observable. And then too, you can do this search, except basically, so this will be S1, this will be S2, this will be S3, and each of these will be singleton states. So the partition will be complete into individual states. Okay? Now, an interesting thing, so the two things that happen because of the observation model is, one, of course, during the search, you have to do AND OR search. The second thing is, during the execution of the plan, you essentially have to update your belief state based on the observation you get. So normally, during the execution, suppose I have decided, so I know that I am I'm currently in a particular belief state B1, that's what I believe in, and I know that I'm doing action A1, so just with my head, I can figure out that I get B1 dash as the belief state. This is the prediction. This is what I predict based on the action that I just did. Okay, but then now I look at the observation, and then I say, well, this observation is only consistent with part of B1 dash, which is B1 double dash, which is a subset of B1 dash. This is called update. And normally, this problem in itself is a huge problem. So just, even if you know what you are supposed to do, even if somebody told you what is the, you know, actions you are supposed to be doing, right? When you do an action, figuring out where you are is in itself basically involves prediction followed by update. Okay. The interesting thing, of course, is that particular problem has been called state estimation problem. That is, estimating your state after doing a bunch of actions. And if your actions are uncertain, after doing a huge number of actions and getting many faulty observations, you have a pretty bad idea of where you are. Okay? In the logical representations, in the basically determinist, so without probabilities, state estimation is not as interesting as if you have probabilistic outcomes. If you have actions with stochastic outcomes and you have observations that are noisy, then what you will actually wind up having is belief states when you have stochastic outcomes are essentially distributions over states. Do you understand what I'm saying? A belief state is nothing but a distribution over a state, is a set of states. So S1 to Sn, and then you just write what are the probabilities for each of them. When you do an action, you'll get a somewhat new distribution. And then when you get an observation, you get another new distribution. These distributions are what you're trying to compute. That's state estimation problem. And it's a very interesting problem. Once, you know, it's actually almost, it's worth studying on its own, when you have stochastic outcomes. Okay, the reason why I'm saying this is, what happens if I don't have distributions? Why is it not interesting if you don't have distributions? If I don't have probabilities, why is it not interesting? Basically, it degenerates eventually to set of all states. If you start doing basically actions with, you know, non-deterministic actions, you do enough number of non-deterministic actions and you get enough noisy observations, then eventually you think you are possibly anywhere in the world. And I can't ask you which is more likely because it's non-deterministic. Do you understand what I'm saying? So one of the things I'm hoping you'll get out of these lectures is there are many interconnected topics that people don't see are connected at all. How many of you have heard of things like Kalman filters? Did you realize I just talked about Kalman filters? Okay? Because a Kalman filter is nothing but, you know, a situation where you have continuous state variables and the distribution is Gaussian. And when that happens, it turns out when the distribution is Gaussian and if the transition function is a conditional Gaussian, then this new distribution will also be Gaussian. The nice thing about Gaussians are that they can be represented with just two parameters. An arbitrary distribution can take a large number of parameters to represent. A Gaussian just needs two parameters. And then on top of it, if you do observation, you will still get a Gaussian. And so Kalman filtering is a huge, big, you know, popular topic, because if you assume that everything is Gaussian, then doing state estimation will become computing new mean and variance for the belief distribution. I'll end with this, which is basically, that's particle filtering. Okay, so let me start again. So the robot is, when I start, the robot is here, and it thinks it could be anywhere in the in this corridor. It knows the entire model, but it doesn't know where it really is. So the original distribution is more or less uniform. As it does actions and gets sonar readings, all it's doing is it's doing state estimation. Okay? And by a few actions, it figures out that all the uncertainty is more or less concentrated here. It's zero probability everywhere else. This is also called localization. Okay? And in this particular case, you could think that it's doing Kalman filtering, except Kalman filtering assumptions don't hold, because the distributions won't be Gaussian. So you need to actually do approximate, you know, Bayes network analysis there. These are basically approximate dynamic Bayes networks, a special class, you know, which are solved with particle filters. Now, I probably will get to this aspect when I get to stochastic actions. But you should know, it's in the mail. Do you understand what I'm saying? The reason state estimation is not as interesting without probabilities is not because it's not a problem, but there's nothing much you can do about it. Because after a certain number of uncertain actions and certain number of noisy observations, you will essentially reach a place where, so in terms of this picture, you'll be dots all over the place, in essence. It's not a distribution anymore. You say, I can be here, I can be here, I can be here. Originally, there are few such places. After some number of actions, it can be anywhere, because you're not taking likelihoods into consideration. Okay, so we will stop here. Although I did not get to the online search, which I will get to, I guess, next class, the stuff that we discussed today is completely relevant to reading the paper, the confinement planning and conditional planning paper. So you should start reading that, and we will discuss that as the main topic next time when we meet, which is, I believe, next Wednesday. And then and next Wednesday, I'll also confirm whether we're going to have a class on Friday. If it is, it will be in the same time.